Welcome to another installment of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your host and president of SIMSEC, Matthew Hipple. Today, we are going to delve into one of the famous narratives of Thucydides' Peloponnesian War, the Melian Dialogue. Now, we have taken a look at some of these famous ideas and theories before, specifically Sea Control 71, the Thucydides' Trap with Matthew Marighi interviewing U.S. Naval War College professor Toshi Yoshihara. So today, rather than take a look at the Melian Dialogue as a piece of IR theory, we're going to take a look at the dialogue itself as a historical event. We're going to take a look at Thucydides as a historian, his accuracies, his inaccuracies, some of his perspectives and perhaps biases, and try to delve deeper into the lesson we can learn from the real Melian Dialogue. There's a lot that the story overlooks, from the political to the military, that maybe the story of a brutal Athens imposing its will arbitrarily on a neutral power isn't exactly the reality as events unfolded. And we have the pleasure of having National Defense University professor, former Georgetown professor of mine, Colonel Jay Parker, United States Army, retired, to discuss the Melian Dialogue here with us today. It's a really fantastic conversation, and Professor Parker is someone that we will be bringing back to the podcast in the future. Think of today's podcast as a paraphrasing of the famous Inigo Montoya line from The Princess Bride. For those who often lean on the Melian Dialogue as a lesson on life and the international system, you keep using that historical example. I do not think it means what you think it means. We will be back with Professor Parker and his insights into the Melian Dialogue right after this short break.
Just like the Office of Personnel Management gives away everybody's greatest secrets, SIMSEC and our Sea Control podcast are here to give you the greatest content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Of course, we couldn't do this without you. The podcast listeners, article readers, content contributors, conference attendees, and voluntary leaders. Sea Control isn't just a podcast. And SIMSEC isn't just a website. We are a labor of love by a dedicated community. China already has all of your personal information, so you may as well share a little bit with us. Consider signing up for our membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Receive emails with our latest articles and events. Gain access to your own SIMSEC WordPress account, which will allow you to share articles with our editorial staff and your insight with a broader community. And remember, subscribe, like, and give 5-star rating to us on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. We would still do this podcast even if you thought it was a horrible dumpster fire. But the nice reviews do make us feel a little bit better about ourselves.
And welcome back to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. For folks who study the fields of politics, of strategy, of military history, of military theory, of security, the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides is the book. It's an incredible, incredible tome. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's always telling you the truth, or that there isn't a spin to what's going on. And today, we're going to be taking a look at the Melian Dialogue. And for folks that study international relations, the Melian Dialogue is, it's like the first thing you read. And if it isn't the first thing you read, demand your money back. It is when the Athenians supposedly roll into this island and tell them, well, we're the strongest, you're weak, and we will do whatever the hell we want. If you have a professor that's teaching you about the international system, about military operations, about international law, and how whether or not that's legitimate, this always comes up. But during my college years, I had the distinct privilege of having a professor whose understanding of this Melian Dialogue was a bit more nuanced than the standard line of narrative. And that man is here with us today. We have Jay Parker, professor at National Defense University and United States Army retired. Sir, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here. I was just going to say, you pretty much covered the all the details, and nothing left to say, but thanks. It's been great talking to you, and good night.
Okay, well, everyone, this
has been... You get all the high points.
This is the Sea Control podcast, and no, of course, but our point today is not to go with the standard line of narrative, but to go into your more subtle understanding. You and, of course, Furman Daniel, who's a lunatic and was the best our teaching assistant ever. But that's, of course, getting ahead of ourselves and completely off the topic. The audience, of course, needs to know you. So, as we do at the beginning of every podcast, Professor, if you could take about a minute or two out and explain to the audience who you are, where you're coming from, and why it is you are obsessed with the movie Princess Bride.
Well, the short answer is I'm a dilettante. I have a wide range of interest and a very spotty and erratic background. I was an Army brat, grew up in the 50s and the 60s, so a lot of my approaches are marked or marred, depending on your point of view, by living through the Cold War and the experience of the Vietnam War. Attended the University of Arizona in Tucson, then had the privilege of working on Capitol Hill for a year, an experience I recommend to everyone. Then spent the next 4 or 5 years working on political campaigns and political media before, while I was going to grad school, before I had kind of my road to Damascus moment, and ended up in the Army about 5 or 6 years after most of my contemporaries had made that choice or chosen not to. Pretty conventional early career as an infantry officer in Europe. Then was given an opportunity to go back to graduate school at Columbia University, where I finished my doctorate. Had already done graduate degrees at Arizona State, and the University of Southern California used to have an international relations program in Germany when I was a young officer, where I first got my real taste of IR theory. Taught at the U.S. Military Academy, and then went to Fort Bragg and served as a psychological operations officer, consistent with a lot of my earlier interest in media. Then returned to the military academy by way of the Naval War College at Newport, Rhode Island, one of the best experiences I had in either my academic or military career. And then stayed at the military academy as senior faculty, retired as a colonel after 26 years in 2005. And then through a series of other twists and turns, I eventually found myself at Georgetown, standing in front of a classroom, wondering who this guy with the short haircut was, whose cell phone kept going off in the middle of the class playing the Star Trek theme, or Star Wars theme, I'm sorry, and was at Georgetown for about 3.5 years until I came over to the College of International Security Affairs at National Defense University, which is where I'm now, and chair of the Department in International Security Studies.
So
that was more than 2 minutes, I'm sure.
No, it's quite all right. So one of the things that marked your class, and what I love about your methodology of approaching some of these more conventional, conventional is not the right word, these traditional sources of sort of IR and security theory knowledge is the skepticism with which you approach it, which mostly comes, I'm assuming, from your obsession with the Princess Bride. But before we get into that in particular, so the Melian dialogue, to get on track here, being the IR professor that you are, speaking to rooms of a bunch of high schoolers, 300 strong, who have no idea what the hell is going on, use that skill, if you would, as a way to explain very quickly to the audience sort of the background and the thrust of the Melian dialogue before we start to poke holes in it here.
Sure. The Melian dialogue is probably the best known, as you said, segment of the massive History of the Peloponnesian Wars written by Thucydides, The war itself covered, depending on how you calculate what were the key events, anywhere from 30 to 50 years. But this one particular segment is the one that finds its way into undergraduate political science reading collections, is referenced in international relations textbooks, is often cited in courses in philosophy and history. And the basic underlying facts are that about 15, 16 years into this war between Athens and Sparta, that was really a war between collections of allies of city-states throughout what is now Greece, that spilled over into Asia Minor to the east, where many where in fact much of ancient Greece was, and as far west as Sicily. In the midst of this truly massive, what you could call total global war for the world at the time, there was this island, the island of Milos, whose other distinction is the statue of Venus de Milo that was one of the works of art there. And this little island had centuries before been started as a colony sent out from Sparta. Now there are two different ways in which we can approach this. One is the way in which it's usually kind of presented. Here's poor Milos, this little isolated island out in the middle of the sea, far from the shore, and the Athenians, who had started off this war with very noble ideals, are now kind of on a roll and have become increasingly more brutal and autocratic. And they roll up on the shores of Milos and say, okay, look, you are neutral. You can't be neutral. You're either for us or you're against us. If we allow you to remain neutral, particularly given your key geopolitical position in the world at the time, that's going to make us look weak, not only because of a practical reason, because we'll always have this sort of suspect island in the midst of our territory, but because others are going to say, well, they didn't bow to the will of Athens, so why should we? So here's your choice. You can bow before us and become subject to our laws and subject to our taxation. And, oh, by the way, don't expect to be treated anything near like the ideal of an Athenian life in this great sort of mythic kingdom of culture, art, and political democracy. But it's certainly better than being totally crushed and killed, because believe us, that's what we will do if you do not bow to our will. And the Melians offer a counter dialogue, saying, "But what about morality? What about ethics? What about higher principles and the higher good?" And the Athenians then say, yeah, the really nice blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. But the bottom line is we're strong. And the bumper sticker that is almost always taken from the Melian dialogue, they allegedly say the strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. So suck it up, Milos. The Melians decide, no, they have might of right on their side. Not right that is justified by might, and they decide to resist. And they hold out and eventually, however, succumb to the Athenian will. Athens then makes good on their promise. They kill all the males. They sell all the children and the women into slavery. They salt the earth. They eventually send out a colony from Athens to kind of capitalize on the land, and then they go off to their next conquest. And depending on who is presenting the lesson, the bottom line you're to take from this is that might does make right. The classic realist argument of nations not being stopped or deterred in the pursuit of their interest And therefore, it is important to understand where you, as a state or a person in the state, are in relation to those who have the greatest strength at the time. Or an alternative explanation, sometimes presented, is that there is a higher moral purpose, that there's something to be said for standing up to bullies and rogue nations, and therefore the Athenian bad, Milos good. And those are usually the two kind of stark distinctions that are presented. Those were certainly the ones that I was most familiar with until I got to the Naval War College and for the first time read the entire book in its entirety, uninterrupted, not chopped up, not broken up by reading over the course of 5, 10, 15, 20 years, but did a really intensive study and engaged in seminar arguments over it. And that kind of led me to a different approach to Thucydides in general, but to the Melian dialogue in particular.
So let's break into that very quickly now. Again, everyone's wondering why I keep bringing up Princess Bride, and I'm totally okay if they never understand why. But now we're going to get into that part where you keep using that historical example, "I do not think it means what you think it means," to paraphrase Inigo Montoya. And there's really two complementary ways that you went about this in class. And the first one is sort of break down Thucydides himself as a source, to kind of look at some of his biases, and then to take against those biases, contrast some of those political and military realities that he is not presenting about the island of Milos. So to start that, let's sort of give our listeners, if you can, sort of break down Thucydides the man. And there's and just for the audience in general, if you go out and listen to, for example, the Pritzker Military Libraries podcast, they have a fantastic breakdown of Clausewitz along this same lines, talking about how he. But that's besides the point, sir. Go ahead. Thucydides the man.
Yeah. The looking at Clausewitz as he is, as opposed to how he is sometimes presented, is my second greatest obsession, second only to Thucydides. First of all, it's important to give Thucydides his due. He is part of a generation, and some would say he was the earliest leader in this generation of the first real historians. History was presented not as a way to glorify the existing king and to justify whoever was on the throne, not as a religious study that demonstrates the power of the gods. It was presented in fairly close framework to what we think of as the broader, more objective study of history that we have today, along with Herodotus, who's and their lives overlapped. The contrast between the way they presented structured and argued history with what had gone on before, even among the great Homeric myths that still had woven in them many valuable life lessons and strategic lessons, Thucydides was trying to present as clear and objective a study of events as they really were, in his own words, and to draw forth the lessons that he felt were likely to last for all time. Thucydides was a citizen of Athens. He was in the tradition of Athenian life, had served as a strategos, as a general in the Athenian military, which was a position that was earned over time. Every male citizen who was considered a full citizen and had voting rights and political rights also had an obligation, essentially a lifelong obligation, to serve the military and defend the city-state. He had risen to a fairly significant position. Early on in the war, he was involved in a particular campaign that did not go well. he was lucky in the sense that, unlike some of his contemporaries who had disastrous campaigns, he was not executed, but he was sent into exile for much of the rest of the war. And he was sent to an area that was kind of a crossroads, where he was able to keep track of what was going on in the war after he left. He had been present for all the great debates and discussions in Athens in the lead up to the war. He was certainly familiar with the long relationship between Athens and Sparta beforehand. He had heard the speeches of and had certainly spoken and knew well Pericles, the great Athenian. But because of the way in which class structure and societies were structured in Greece, he also had ties, relationships with his peers in other cities, to include Sparta. And so he had those kinds of contacts. And as he was sitting there in exile, he would gather the stories of, hey, what's happened since I've left? And he'd hear a Spartan version, or he'd hear an Athenian version, and then he'd hear the versions from all the other important city-states involved. And he'd kind of triangulate as best he could and try and verify. And so he began to kind of compose this work over time. The book ends before the actual end of the war, although there's some evidence in the book that he actually lived through the end of the long war. In fairness to Thucydides, he tries to be fairly objective. Where there are stupid errors of greed or vanity or stubbornness or naivete on the part of the Athenians, he'll call them out. And where the Spartans make wise strategic choices, he will give them their due. Having said all that, you have to bear in mind that, number one, he's got some baggage. He was fired. Number two, he has an inherent view of political, social, economic, and military life that is decidedly Athenian and in line with Athens' history. And he eventually, when his exile ends, goes back to Athens. So he is not without some sort of bias and a point of view, which he himself will admit to. But sometimes when you're reading this long and complex history, you have to stop and remind yourself from time to time that the guy who wrote it wasn't some alien from outer space who didn't have any sort of a dog in the fight on either side, and who had total perfect knowledge and total visibility on all events. He was human, and there were limits to what he saw. There were limits to how he interpreted things. And so that has to be kind of taken into account as one of the first points. Now, much of what Thucydides wrote was echoed by some other historians, to include Herodotus. Some of what he has written has been verified through archaeology and other studies. There was a long period of time where he was not viewed, and by long, I mean centuries, where he was not viewed as a significant, important scholar or historian to study. His works were viewed as highly suspect. And as we went into what we call the Dark Ages in the medieval era, his books fell into almost complete ignorance on the part of the people. The public was, first of all, not that literate and educated, but even among the literate and educated, he wasn't followed that clearly. As you began to see the birth of the Enlightenment and the reaching back to Greek and Roman writings, and a lot of these documents that had been kind of squirreled away began to make their way out, Thucydides is one of the ones that emerges. But even when he reemerges, you can't separate him from those who sort of rediscovered him, translated him, and presented him. Particularly relevant, I think, to the way the Melian dialogue is often depicted, is the fact that one of his first translators, editors, spinmeisters and salesmen when the book began to reemerge was Thomas Hobbes. And what do we remember that Thomas Hobbes told us about the nature of life and what the world is like? That was a pause for you to answer, Matt.
Short, brutish, and something about it being terrible, I'm sure.
Nasty, yeah. Nasty, yes. Brutish, and short. So those who were advancing particular philosophies or approaches to the contending views that were coming out of that era would adopt Thucydides and, you know, just as they would adopt the writings of Plato and Aristotle and others. So there was a little bit of cutting and pasting that went on. Arguably, some of the better, clearer, and more complete translations of Thucydides really didn't reemerge until the last century and a half. So you had this really massive, majestic, and kind of exhausting look at this very, very complex event that that had been dormant for thousands and thousands of years. So when it's revived, it's being spun through the prism of those who revived it, but it's also being spun by the readers who are saying, that's exactly like fill in the blank. You know, what's happening now? You know, the Napoleonic era, or the American Civil War, or the rise of America as an imperial power, or the run-up to World War I. And you can take almost any significant strategic event of the last 250, 300 years, and you can find somebody who somehow throws the name Thucydides into the mix, and more often than not, the name of Milos gets mentioned in the bargain.
So now that we've sort of given the long-form histrionics of Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War, let's get to the meat of it, because ultimately this is a podcast not about Thucydides, though ultimately it is. Everything is about Thucydides, as we've discussed already.
Right.
But so the Melian dialogue, the Melians themselves, sort of break down. Let's take this, so we have this island that's supposedly neutral and just wants to be left alone, and oh, it's so weak, and the Athenians are so strong.
This great haven of pacifism and neutrality.
Exactly. There's just a commune in the middle of the ocean, and they just want to raise their organic free-range chickens and have gluten-free gyros, you know, all that kind of stuff, and then these brutal Athenians come in and murder them all. let's get down to the real story here. What was Milos?
Yeah, this is where you have to start getting complicated. And to kind of jump ahead and you know, spoiler alert, give away the ending, the reason why I and some others teach it this way is not just to show that, there's more to the story than you think, but to recognize that in all strategic clashes and all monumental events, there are layers within layers, and if you start off thinking you've got an answer to begin with that you want to expand on, rather than starting off asking questions, you've lost the benefit of studying this. And the advantage of looking at Milos in a bit greater depth and looking at the entire events in greater depth is if you are going to make correlations to, say, some strategic challenge you're facing today, you hopefully force yourself to say, okay, that's what appears to be the obvious connection, but what are the points that are not so obvious? What's the story behind the story? In the case of Milos, as I said originally, it had been a Spartan colony, albeit several hundred years before this occurred. But it had remained close with the Spartan alliance, had refused to join the Delian League, which was the alliance that was dominated by Athens, and gave aid to Sparta in the early parts of the Peloponnesian Wars. And so, in fact, they were not neutral, and the Spartans knew it, and the Athenians knew it, and the Melians certainly knew it. Athens had actually attempted to bring Milos into the fold by force some 10 years before the Melian dialogue, and even though they were not successful, they went ahead and sort of put them in their books of here are countries who owe us money, owe us an assessment, basically protection money that they were charging to other countries. The Malians continued to present themselves as relying on the Spartans for security. So about 416 BCE, the Athenians decide, okay, we're going back. And what had transpired in the meantime is that the goals and objectives and high principles that the Athenians said they were advancing at the start of the war had given away to lots of things. First of all, the war at this point had been going on for well over a decade. There'd even been a couple of little pieces and truces in between. So you had the human emotions of revenge, of grief, of anger that were creeping in. Pericles, this great figure who had set forth the principles of not only what Athens' goals were in the war, but why they were important in terms of what Athens represented as a state, was dead. The great plague had come in, and he had been one of the victims who had died. And the people who followed after him, even those who were his allies, were not up to his measure as great leaders. So the rhetoric, the emotions, and the ideals had started to give way. Also, the Athenians were not exactly just kind of rolling over and knocking off states left and right. The whole process of bringing and keeping allies to their side was proving to be very difficult, especially in the long term. So the idea that it did matter that you had nations out there portraying themselves as neutral could be something that could be viewed as a sign of weakness. So the Athenians decide to go back, but bear in mind that one of the interesting things about studying the Peloponnesian Wars is how very formal all these states were. Diplomacy really mattered. The Clausewitzian principle that you do not stop negotiating and do not end diplomacy once the shooting starts any more than you stop being prepared for war while you are negotiating and at peace really plays out in the way the states behave. There were certain norms and processes, and once you, as a nation, ascribe to an oath, it was not uncommon for a treaty, once it was agreed to be read out to the assembled multitudes of citizens who had a voice in government, and they all had to take that oath, and they would literally carve it in stone, and if they were going to break a peace, they would only do so if they could prove that the other side had somehow violated the oaths. So this wasn't Athens just kind of rolling in and kicking people over left and right. They had actually come in and said, we would like to address your citizens and explain to them the choice. And the magistrates, the rulers of Melos, said, no, you talk to us. You don't talk to them.
Before we get into that piece, correct me if I'm wrong, and of course my memory of college IR might be a bit fuzzy, but Melos was also right kind of on the southern part of that island archipelago, was at the crossroads of major trade routes, and was known for piracy, if I'm correct.
Well, I can't speak to the accuracy of the piracy, but it was not unknown in that part of the ocean. So, and as you say, it was at a crossroads, this was strategic terrain. This was not some barren, ice-covered, uninhabited island. This was a vital part of the trade routes, and it was an important part of the Spartan alliance in that sense. So this was not just some random, hey, that island looks interesting, let's go over and make their lives miserable. So the Athenians start out kind of laying out their case, saying, look, here's the deal.
Doesn't the case start out with literally them walking in, and this I think speaks to your point about how this is a long relationship. This isn't a sudden Athens says, you know what, these Melians, let's go kick their, shins in. Let's kill them. Is they literally start out, and it almost sounds like they're frustrated. They go into the room, and they say, we're not talking about laws, we're not talking about morality, we're explaining to you that we're going to come in here and wreck your shit if you don't listen to us. And I found it rather shocking as I read this, is this doesn't sound like Athens. This isn't how Athens goes around. There's got to be something behind the way they open negotiations. With these oligarchs, and they say, no, listen, we're laying it down now. We're done playing games with you.
Yeah, and if you take the assumption that this had just been a peaceful little island out there in the water, and the Athenians decided to become bullies one day, it is very shocking. But again, if you realize that they had been kind of poking their finger in the eye of Athens for over a decade at this point, that the Athenians were not exactly winning every battle anyway, and they had made overtures to Milo several times. Well, suddenly it's not really all that odd that they would come in and say, okay, enough is enough. But even then, even when they come and make that approach, they don't just show up and start setting fire to everything. Which they had done and would do in the future to other places, they actually come in and say, okay, we're going to talk about this, and we're going to give you an option. You may not like the choices, you may not like the option, but we're presenting you with options. And when you stop and think about that, the question of, okay, just how really above any sort of blame or consideration could we really say the Melians were, regardless of how they try and couch everything in a very moralistic manner. Not to say that the Melians don't believe a lot of this, but they believe it, but at the same time they had sent off to Sparta and said, you know, come quick, cousins, we're in trouble and we're relying on you. In the end, you could say that one of the many mistakes the Melians made was over-relying on one particular ally. And many people have pointed out, gee, if you are an island, do you really want to rest all of your security on the power of the great land power going up against the greatest sea power? That seems a little bit odd. It would seem to me you would want to hedge your bets. If nothing else, reach out to some of the other nations who had challenged Athens, who had stronger navies, and build up your own capabilities to resist. So that was one of the flaws to begin with. One of the other problems is that it's often depicted as, okay, the Melians were given the choice. The Athenians listened to them, but basically said, we don't care what you say, we're going to beat you up. And then they did. Well, the fact is that the campaign to capture and actually subjugate Milos went on for well over a year. At one point, the Athenians sail away and leave a small siege force and come back. And there were several points where the Melians scored significant tactical victories. But as with most tactical victories, what's the value added if you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot strategically? And the fact was, if you were continuing to resist after having been given these options, the likelihood of the Athenians saying, well, I guess we better go away now, it kind of diminishes. Especially if you've gone about a year and a half and you've yet to see anything in the way of help from Sparta. So this sort of clear delineation of innocent Milos, bad guy Athens is not quite the way it's laid out. Yes, Milos was the weaker. Yes, Milos was a little bit off the beaten path. And yes, even many historians have referred to Athens at this point in the Peloponnesian War as being on a roll of tyrannic behavior and far from that democratic ideal we often associate with Athens. But still, the questions that need to be asked up front are often ignored.
And I think a particular point, and you've thrown some of that stuff out there, but you know, people fail to realize the Melians weren't defeated until they were betrayed. So,
well, that's my favorite part of the Melian dialogue is you get through this long, very, in many cases, very beautiful and in some cases very moving rhetoric and these great enunciations of principles of that are still argued in international relations theory to this day and these gripping accounts of these tactical actions. And then you get down to literally the last paragraph in this particular chapter, and there's this interesting little sentence that says, owing to some treachery inside the walls. Now, first of all, it indicates that the Athenian victory was not assured until somebody on the Melian side, essentially opened the gates. Whether it was through, not staging a strong enough defense and making surrender inevitable or literally opening the gates, is not entirely clear. But what is clear is that there was dissent within Melos. And what is clear is that the internal domestic politics, really matter on both sides. And much is written about what happened to the internal domestic politics of Athens as the war progressed and how democracy degenerated and some of the flaws inherent in a direct democracy that led to the war. But little attention is paid, in my experience, to the fact that there were domestic politics in these other states as well that affected whether or not the Athenians were able to work their will or whether they ran up against, as they did in other cases, much stronger adversaries who were more organized and more effective and had greater legitimacy with their population than apparently the magistrates in Melos did. After all, they did not take what was often the tradition of allowing the ambassadors from Athens to speak to the population as a whole. No. Don't speak to the rabble out there. We'll tell the rabble what we want them to know about what Athens' message is. So the internal structure and political life and political process inside of Melos, much of which I'm sure was based on institutions in place when the war began, really mattered in terms of the outcome. And who wins and who loses.
This is indicative of your broad study, but the point that I was trying to push for was the fact that everyone talks about how weak Melos is, and yet the end of Melos was someone, and I've always lended myself to think it was literally someone opening up the gates in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Makes for a much more dramatic movie scene, but
It's not such a great story if it's not really these underdogs, but these incredibly tactically competent military island people. And once you realize what a hard time Athens is having with these guys, you're like, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah.
The beginning of this thing was you guys being so weak.
Poor innocent little lambs.
And
that's not the case. And the fact is that if Sparta or any of its allies had even lifted a finger and even done a moderate degree of naval action to intercept, I mean, after all, Melos is an island, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert on maritime strategy, but as I recall, to get from a mainland to an island, you do have to go over water, and there's certain vulnerabilities that you have, and the Spartans, whose navy was, not certainly as great as the Athenian navy, but it was still fairly good, and the Corcyraeans and others had navies that were often viewed as in tactical terms, the equals of the Athenians, and the Athenians didn't even commit their greatest generals and their strongest leaders to this particular campaign. If Sparta had wanted to, they could have really tipped the balance, and clearly the Melians, for a significant portion of this campaign, were holding their own until whoever it is, someday maybe they'll uncover a stone tablet that tells the whole story and names names, but whoever it was who unlocked the gates and was part of the treachery inside the walls, tips the balance, this is not a sure thing. And the way it is often depicted is the Athenians had won before they even arrived because of the strength of their argument. The strong do what they will, and the weak suffer what they must. And there are even some who will go so far as to say, and I don't read ancient Greek, so I couldn't confirm this, but there are a number of scholars far more credible than I that say, you know, that translation is not exactly what the Athenians were saying. It's a translation that's been added on and expanded after the fact. It's a way that people who are presenting the Melian dialogues want to see it interpreted.
This is, I'm going to go down a different beaten path here, but would you happen to know what that alternative wording is? Or what's some
no,
of the alternative?
I don't. I mean, it's just that it was a little bit more ambiguous, that it's not so much that they said something else, it's that they didn't actually come out and say, the strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. You can certainly draw that inference from what they're saying. That's one of those things that happens when words get put in the mouth of historic figures. But there's another point beyond this that I want to kind of leap ahead to, and let me know if I'm veering too far off script, but I know you and I have discussed this before. When you look at the Melian dialogue as an isolated incident in the Peloponnesian Wars, you're going to come away with certain conclusions, some of them about Athenian power and the advisability of the choice they made. If you look at events that happen later in the Peloponnesian Wars, ones that essentially signaled the end of any realistic strategic hope of Athenian victory, and trace the genealogy back to what happened at Melos, there is, at least in my view, a connection, one that demonstrates a continuing change for the worse in Athenian behavior and in Athenian thinking about strategic choices and options, and one that also can be tied to the increased resistance and strength of many of the alliances that ultimately opposed and brought down the Athenians. And I'm talking specifically about the Sicilian campaign and the complete destruction of the Athenian expedition to conquer the Syracusans some years later. And in my mind, much as you and I, you know, think of some sneaky guy creeping up to the lock on the gate of the major wall around Melos, I think of that moment when Nicias, the Athenian leader, thinking that he has won or at least secured a good position on land and is secure by the sea, looks out and sees all these ships that are Syracusan allies, to include Spartans and those from many other city-states, has to be thinking, okay, the chickens from Melos are coming home to roost. All those smaller powers and states who we said, surrender or die, have basically told each other in the language of the American Revolution, join or die. And you see a pattern that presents itself again and again and again in history. When you get a very, very strong state, that begins to push its military, economic, and political weight around, smaller states and smaller entities begin to find ways to chip at the margins and the boundaries and gradually weaken that state and eventually the order changes, sometimes for good, sometimes for chaos. But in the case of Athens, the tone that they set in Melos, which in many ways was a significant shift in how they had acted before. There were other city-states that they had come up to and other islands, and they had given basically the same ultimatum. And the people on the islands have said, okay, or in some cases put up token resistance. But when the Athenians asserted their power, they didn't salt the earth and they didn't kill all the men and send the women and children into slavery. And there was just this gradual hardening and toughening and greater falling away from any sort of moral compass of the Athenian approach to pursuing its interest. In fact, you could argue that the Athenian interest got murkier and murkier and murkier. What did they start out to do, and what did they end up attempting to do by the time they got to Sicily and were faced with the Syracusans? And those were two very different ideals and goals. And the Melian dialogue and the defeat of Milos in many ways sort of foretells or starts Athens down the road to its own defeat some years later.
You know, and that's interesting that you go down this path, because listening to you talk actually makes me think a lot about the First World War in the conduct of the war itself, how that changed so much between the war itself just impacted the mentality of people and how an entire generation changed. And, you know, the amount of time that this conflict was going on with the Athenians, you have to wonder how this changed, this endless conflict changed their psyche, how it may have made them more paranoid or made them change the way they executed their calculus.
That's a very good point. There are no examples that I'm aware of where a state, be it the winner or the loser, comes out the other side of a war unchanged. Maybe for the better and oftentimes for the worse, but they are not the same state as they were when it began. And the conduct of the war affects that. And it sets in motion the way in which the state views itself and the way others view it. Again, to go back to Milos, there's some historical evidence that anti-Athenian propaganda that was circulated among the other city states, whose position in different alliances was crucial, kept coming back to the Melian dialogue, you know, some variation of remember the Melians, and that not only defined the way others viewed Athens, but arguably was a not that unfair depiction of how Athens had come to define itself, just as other nations over the course of the First World War, over the course of the Second World War, over the course of, you know, fill in the blank, any nation views itself after a conflict, particularly one so long and so all-encompassing, and one that really does demonstrate all those dimensions of warfare, that you cannot pry loose from each other. You cannot pry the economic away from the political. You cannot pry the political away from the military. You cannot pry the military away from the technological, and et cetera, et cetera. They're all bound up together, as everyone, you know, Clausewitz, Sun Tzu, the great South Asian strategist writing in the Arthur Shastra, Machiavelli, try to make it clear that all of those dimensions, to include, as you say, the psychological and the emotional, are inseparable. And it's not just a matter of, you know, I have more bows and arrows than you do, or you have more ships than I do. There are deeper dimensions to that. That yes, whoever is the biggest and baddest on any given day may be the tactical winner, but that doesn't mean they're going to be the strategic winner. That doesn't mean their interests are going to be secured or advanced, and that doesn't mean they're going to become a greater state even if they do win.
And ultimately, that doesn't mean that the way the story is written is the way it actually was executed ultimately.
Well, we have that as well. I mean, we do know that Thucydides was in Athens for many of the early debates of the war. We do know he was present in many campaigns. But it is a almost certain reality that he was not in Milos for that campaign and certainly didn't hear those discussions. Did he hear them from several different quarters and from several different people? I'm sure he did, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're all entirely accurate, that there weren't pieces of the discussion that were missing. And there are elements of what he presents in the Melian Dialogue that are bolstered by historic accounts and archaeological accounts and others that came out later. And there are some pieces that say, well, yeah, he got this right, but that doesn't mean he got everything that really mattered when he was looking at this. To a certain extent, as with much history, it's still unfolding.
So we talked a little bit about the historionics on Thucydides at the beginning, yeah. But you've sort of brought me back around to it. The Melian Dialogue, we talked about Thucydides in general. Is there something
right.
about his particular perspective or the campaign that he was involved in, or perhaps his affinity for certain politics and policies by Pericles, or whatever the case mm-hmm. What drove him to show Athens in this light? Because as you say, he wasn't there, and the story that he got was second and third hand, perhaps first hand. He probably knew the strategos and diplomats of the day, but what do you think drove him to show Athens in this light?
I think to a certain extent we kind of have to take him at his word that he wanted to show events as they were, that he wanted to show those lessons that were important for all time, not just for sorting out a particular war or the fate of a particular state, and that this was important to him. There are many people who, in the course of conflicts or later, set out to write their memoirs. And you and I could make a long list, I'm sure, of the ones that are self-serving and the ones that are perhaps even harder on the author than they should be. But there are some who set out to say, I realize both the strengths and the weaknesses of my own point of view, and I want to present this as objectively as I can. And I want to account for the fact, or at least acknowledge the fact, that I may not have all the information or all the answers. And that's one of the reasons why he's such a significant figure, not just because we can look at him and assess the credibility of the history of the Peloponnesian War, but because on a certain level, having those ideals that he at least attempted to carry out in his writing is something worth emulating. How many times have you and I, in the course of our respective military careers, seen after-action reports or post-battle reports or whatever that were clearly either perfunctory or self-serving or leaving out very significant key portions of what was going on? And how often do you read something that really does attempt to say, let's really get at what is the key here? I remember an after action report for something that I was involved in when I was in at Fort Bragg in the PSYOP community, and it was being circulated around, and it said all the right things and referenced all the right doctrine and what we did according to FM blah blah blah, and people bloviated their comments on it. And then it got to our battalion S3, our operations officer, who was kind of a crusty but very, very smart special forces officer who was later awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for incredible heroism in early on in Iraq. And his only comment was, yes, these are great lessons learned. They were also great lessons learned the last time we did this. In other words, we just didn't learn them. We like to keep writing them, but we're not being very reflective, and we're not being objective. We're not being self-critical where we need to be. We're not being praising of taking the right choices and making the right decisions when we should be. If lessons are to mean anything, then we have to approach them as thoroughly and objectively as we can and let the chips fall where they may. And for that reason, Thucydides is one of the books that I find myself coming back to again and again and again. not so much to say, aha, this is an exact parallel to Fallujah, or this is an exact parallel to how what we're facing with the Boko Haram, but to the broader process of how do we ask ourselves the right questions, and how do we challenge our own assumptions, and how do we take stories that we know to be true and look at them again to see if maybe there isn't another truth to be known.
So, interesting. So the Melian dialogue is almost 50% of fiction, but meant sort of a metaphor for what happened throughout the war. Kind of, this is the story not of this island, but this is the story of kind of who mm-hmm. we're becoming.
To a certain extent. How much of that Thucydides fully grasped at the time, and how much did he kind of realize that later? We can never really know, because he didn't, you know, leave any notes, and, you know, there were no talk shows back then that he could go on and discuss, you know, his thinking process, you know, Fresh Air with Terry Gross or The Daily Show or, you know, Fox News or whatever, where he could talk about why he wrote the book. So we have to kind of extrapolate that. And even if we look at the Melian dialogue as a sort of historical fiction, and I think there's probably more history than fiction there, but clearly there are things that were structured or built into that and lessons drawn out from it that may not have reflected the actual chronology. What are the bigger lessons that we can take? Not so much the lessons of saying, this is what the Melians did, let's not do that, but rather kind of stepping back and saying, what is the essence of the strategic situation here? Who are the actors? What are their interests? What are their opportunities? What are the challenges that they face? What really is at stake here, and what are the second and third order effects? If you put the Melian dialogue in the context of the rest of the history of the Peloponnesian War, you can have answers to those kinds of questions. If you just view it as a little discussion between a weak pacifist island that doesn't want to get involved and a big bully superpower that wants to come in and trample everything in its path, you're gonna miss the point. And it's not going to do you much good as a framework for approaching the next security challenge you find yourself up against, the nature of which you could not predict and could not know. But the tools with which you approach that new challenge, using whatever frameworks for analysis you've taken from the Melian dialogue and other writings, still has great value.
And I think that is an excellent note to end on, considering that our 30-minute conversation has extended into a full hour, so let's hope the compression doesn't absolutely ruin the audio quality. I'm sure it'll be fine.
It always happens with us, Matt, yes. Whenever we, our 5-minute conversations tend to
skip out on a whole class. You can skip out on a whole class now. You just put this, go to sleep at the front, and just play this on the speakers.
But as you and I both know, we'll do that, and then there will be someone in the back of the room will say, you know what I just noticed? And if you weren't paying attention, you'll miss the new insight. It's like I used to say to you in my other classes that I will learn more over the course of the semester from you than you will learn from me. And much of the kind of pushing and give and take that I got from you and the other great students in that particular class taught me at least as much about Thucydides as I tried to impart to you. So don't fall asleep in class, I guess, is the bottom line there.
And we will definitely come back, as I've mentioned to the professor earlier. I fully intend to drag him back on here to talk more about Thucydides and mostly movies, as I do remember with fondness the class everyone thought was a joke, the movie, what was it, theater and film and international relations, which was anything but, considering the debate that occurred over the movie 7 Days in May, which I still browbeat people over who have seen the movie. I had a Guinness-fueled 4 or 5 hour conversation with my friend John Fang on the civil-military relationship aspects of 7 Days in May. But before we close out, as we'll have plenty of time to reflect on other topics here in the future, but for today in particular, is there anything, you know, about a minute, 2 minutes here, because we are really pushing the clock. Not that I mind, of course, but our listeners probably have all turned off, so screw you guys. You're not listening to this anyways. Is there anything that you'd like to leave us with, any final thoughts, anything that you think that we haven't discussed, or a point that you've sort of discovered through this conversation, as in the back and forth is educational, a little nugget that you'd like to leave us with? It could be even a book that isn't even on security that you're reading that you want to recommend to us. It's free form, whatever you'd like to throw out there.
Always look to the bigger picture. Don't narrow yourself strictly to what it is that that you are most comfortable with. Over the last month or so, I forced myself, well, not forced because I enjoyed it, to read a book about Kim Jong-il's domination of the North Korean film industry to include kidnapping a famous South Korean director and actress. In a book called Kim Jong-il Production, reading a fascinating new biography of James Madison by Mike Siner called Becoming Madison, a biography of William Shire, the journalist who covered Germany before the Second World War and then later wrote Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and even going back and reading some histories of the very early days of the American experience, and how we evolved into who we are. And in every book, in every movie, in the poems, I start out each day with a new poem. In every work of art, there is something to give us insight into ourselves, into the world we live in, and into those two great questions, the why of war and the how of peace. So don't constrain yourself to a particular discipline or field of study or theme of readings.
And with that, we come to a close. So, Professor, it has been an absolute pleasure, and I certainly hope, and I look forward to, and I hope our listenership does as well, as I trust they do, look forward to having more conversations like this in the future.
It would be my absolute pleasure.